It's time to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens with host Nate Wilcox. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. This week, Nate is joined by author David Wondrich to discuss his overlooked classic, Stomp and Swerve, How American Music Got Hot, 1843 to 1924. In this episode, David takes Nate way, way back into the history of American music, long before the invention of recording, to discuss how African-derived music in North America differs from its sister music in South America and the Caribbean, as well as America's primordial pop phenomenon, the minstrel show, and all the associated racist baggage that comes with it. Country music's surprising roots in African-American music, and the black performers and songwriters who seized the opportunities presented to break the color barriers which had kept black performers off professional stages until nearly the turn of the 20th century. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why American music happened with your host, Nate Wilcox. And today I've got a very special guest, a guy I'm very excited to have on the show, but also one I was literally afraid to invite on, David Wondrich, the author of Stomp and Swerve. He's not only one of America's leading historians of mixology. Is that correct, David?
I guess so. it's not really a formal field, put it that way.
But you write about the history of liquor mixing for GQ. This is correct.
Esquire.
Forgive me, my bad. We can go back and tape that out. I'm just kidding. But no, if you want, we could.
No, I don't care. I wrote good. For Esquire for 17 years. Now I write for the Daily Beast, and awesome. I've written books. I won the James Beard Award. All this stuff, all for that. But before that, I used to write about music.
And that's when you wrote this book that I came across last year in my inexplicably deepening obsession with American musical history. And the book is called Stomp and Swerve, American Music Gets Hot, from 1843 to 1924. And I've been going further and further back. And this is the only book I've found that is both willing to go further back than the beginning of recorded music and is focused on what you call hot music, which is the synthesis of African-American and European music, most specifically African-American and Celtic-American musics.
Well, let me tell you how the book kind of came about, because that will explain its sort of weird, unique position. Is I was going to write something I called The Prehistory of Rock and Roll, and this was in the late 90s. At the same time, I had just finished graduate school and started teaching, so I didn't have a lot of time. But I started on the book, and I was going to start around 1918 with Louis Armstrong and King Oliver. And the more I looked into it, the further back I had to push things, because I started to realize, wait a minute, this wasn't the beginning at all. What I thought was the beginning was, sort of the midpoint of this huge transformation and this birth of rock and roll. And so I started, I'm a very kind of literal, straight ahead thinker. So I started writing at the beginning, and by the time my publisher was howling for the book, I'd only gotten about halfway. So I realized, but at the same time, I realized that that was actually the most unique part of the story and would make a book on its own. So I stopped before I got into the 1920s hillbilly and hot jazz and swing bands and the birth of R&B and all that. But all that stuff's been talked about.
Exactly.
The stuff I talked about, not really. But the weirdness of the book is I kind of wrote it as a work of rock criticism, not as music history. So it's the music history people were kind of flummoxed by it, because it's not written in music history style. And the rock people were just like, this stuff is really old.
Exactly. And the music history style, as much as I have plowed my way through several college textbooks on American musical history, they tend to be dry and dusty. And this book, I think, I can't say it's as alive as the music it describes, because nothing really is as alive as American music in its purest, deepest, darkest form. and undocumented form. But I can say the book is lively and really entertaining and enormously educational. But first, we've got to get one thing out of the way. You talk
about how,
if I can quote from the preface, you say these days, and this is 20 years old at this point, so it's even worse now. These days, the odds are pretty good that even the most hardened bluegrass fiend, blues scholar, jazz bow, or ragtimer grew up listening to the same crap as the rest of us. Anyway, the line of influence from antebellum minstrel Daniel Decatur, Emmett, to Kid Rock, from Burt Williams, the first black man to appear on a Broadway show, to Outkast, is unbroken, though rarely acknowledged. And you say there's two reasons. One is technical. You know, we didn't have recording until, what, the 1870s, 1890s, and most of this, you know, this stuff's off and running by the 1840s. But the second reason, and this is your words, this brings us to our second bigger reason. During the eight decades covered by this book, as during the eight since, the dominant issue in American music was the tense, dynamic relationship between its African elements and its European ones, which is a polite way of saying that white men and women were imitating, often very poorly and not always with the best intentions, what they heard black men and women playing and singing. Much of this imitation involves language and stereotypes that make people very, very uncomfortable. Misty-eyed evocations of plantation days, crude and violent tales of the supposed realities of ghetto life like that. A lot of it is just plain racist trash, music made with intent to insult. As the wise and worldly Lord Chesterfield instructed his son, mimicry is the lowest and most illiberal of all buffoonery. The person mimicked is insulted, and an insult is never forgiven. Whether it should be forgiven is not mine to say. But then you say, whether it should nonetheless be examined, though, is a different question. Distressing as this stuff can be, it's all we've got. And so I wanted you to elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it has only gotten more sensitive since. But and in terms of, like, bringing a lot of this stuff back as popular entertainment, I would say hell no. But if you're going to look at the history of American music, there's nowhere else to look, you know? That's the problem. That's what we're up against.
And I think it's very important to acknowledge that the history of American music is no more racist, probably less racist than the history of America, which is, you know, I think one of the beauties of the Black Lives Matter movement is it's really forced us to focus on just how racist our history is and continues to be.
Exactly.
This is not a problem we solved in the 60s.
No, it was not a problem that was solved. It goes back to the very beginning of the country. It's baked into the country's DNA practically. You know, it's something that people got to work on every day. And it's baked into the music. What amuses me the most is the attempt to deny the black influence and the influence of this theft that's kind of moved into things like country music, which, you know, presents itself as being this completely sort of lily white, where just Appalachian music kind of that came over from England in the 1700s, and that's our roots. That's not the roots at all. Country music is completely Africanized. All types of American music are completely Africanized.
And even all you bluegrass. Have to do to prove your case is point to the dominant instrument of bluegrass, which is probably seen as the whitest of all American music, and yet the dominant instrument is the banjo, which was invented where?
Africa.
Exactly.
Completely, you know, it's a complete African instrument. And, you know, bluegrass music is a great, is also just kind of a great case of all this stuff, because bluegrass music was almost explicitly pushed as being a cleaned up, more traditional, let's get rid of all the minstrel show influence version of old time music, as it's called, which is the music that came out of the minstrel shows and went, you know, kind of went folk. And so it's attempting to put itself as being really very white. But then you get into bluegrass music and you realize that they've got all these, like, what they would call takeoff solos, long improvisational solos. And that's completely absent from the European music. And that's completely part of the African-American tradition. So it's almost something that you can't pull out.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I consider all of America one big family. and you just can't disconnect the DNA musically any more than you can disconnect the DNA physically. But I want to switch a little bit to your personal origin story. In the book, you tell this story about when you're a kid and two albums that you bought around the same time, Never Mind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, which you describe as, I thought it was intense, more intense than anything ever. And the second album you picked up right around this time was something you'd never heard of before called King of the Delta Blues Singers, Volume 2 by Robert Johnson. What were you thinking when you bought those albums?
Well, the Sex Pistols were, you know, I was into music and I had a subscription to Rolling Stone. And so I got, I went out and got the Sex Pistols album when it turned out. And I was like, holy Hannah, what the hell is this thing? You know, this kind of sums up all adolescent angst and anger and misfit feelings and all that kind of stuff, and just throws it right back in people's faces. So it was, you know, profoundly oppositional. And the Robert Johnson one I got because I had checked out from the school library a little book called Feels Like Going Home, which is the history of I'm blanking for a moment on the author's name because it's been so long since I've read all this stuff.
And this is something I should be able to tell you, but I am.
Yeah, I know. It'll come to me afterwards. Anyways, you know, one of the great music writers, and he had a chapter on Robert Johnson, so I saw this record and it was a cutout, and so I bought it and took it home and I put it on, and I was like, oh, punk rock. You know, it was
exactly.
Like just a slashing, and there's some of the same feelings, this slashing, like intense, deeply felt, it sounded crude. I learned later by, you know, repeated listening how not crude it was, but at first listen, you know, if you're used to like polished stuff and the stuff that made it on the radio kind of like as blues, stuff like Cream, you know, it was not like Cream.
Definitely not. And Peter Guralnick is the author of Feels Like
Yeah,
Home,
thank
so
you.
I definitely
God,
should've.
I can't believe I blanked on that. But, you know, I haven't studied this stuff in a very long time. I still listen to all the music. But that was an amazing book.
Yeah, brains are rotting as we speak. That's just the nature of human.
Sad. You know, I think at a faster rate than ever now. But anyway.
Yes, speaking from my experience, that's definitely the case. But one thing I like about the book is you know, you've got the preface and you explain kind of the genesis of the book, but then you get into the introduction and you get into the theory of the book. And I'm a sucker for theory. And so you've got this theory that, you know, the first off, the book is about hot music. So if it's staid, if it's stodgy, it's off topic. Even something like the Jubilee Singers that are absolutely as key to the development of American music and especially African American music as anybody are not really in your category. Explain that a little bit.
Well, again, you know, the book was conceived as a prehistory of rock and roll. So I was looking at the stuff that was directly in the rock and roll tradition. And that meant, you know, I had to leave out a lot of stuff like the Jubilee Singers who are really interesting and, you know, who are produced a lot of wonderful records, but they were kind of aiming at an African American art music. And I was looking more for just the kind of cheap throwaway stuff like rock and roll that, you know, managed to resonate beyond its age by its vitality. And so that, kind of was liberating because I didn't have to write about everything, you know. I could just write about this one tradition, this strain in American music. But that's the strain that became dominant in American music success worldwide. And so it was actually, you know, sort of the rejected stone that became the cornerstone of the temple.
Absolutely. And I think you do a great job of drawing a direct line from minstrelsy to ragtime to jazz. And the implications are very clear from there. You know, people like Ed Ward, my frequent guest on the show, mm-hmm. have connected the dots between jazz to swing, to rhythm and blues, to rock and roll, to hip hop, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing you quote, or a quote I want to cite here, it says, "What if our ears tell us that Possum in the Hayloft by a cracker fiddle band from Georgia, Nixed by Mir by a Yiddish clarinet combo from Hester Street, and Peephole Drag by a black cornet blower from the south side of Chicago were equally hot, although they seem to have nothing in common." How do you explain that? And you say, "Fortunately, I'm not a musicologist." So there are other ways of approaching this question. And explain how you solve this dilemma. How you define hot, the two factors, the two ingredients that go into making hot music.
Well, I'd spent 10 years playing in bands, so I was not completely, free of, I had some musical knowledge, but I was definitely not a musicologist and didn't have any technical vocabulary to discuss music. But I also had a PhD in comparative literature, which taught me to be sort of fearless about applying theories to stuff and trying to get to the essences of things so you can compare them while discarding all the flourishes. And so I started, spent months on this trying to figure out what these things actually have in common. And I came up with this. It's not like so much a theory as it is a way of explaining things. And it's that hot music has two factors. It's got stomp, which is something we all know. That's the strong, repetitive, banging on a head rhythm. Just bang, 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 bang. And all kinds of music have that. Some of it, all kinds of dance music have it. Marches have it. Music that we don't necessarily consider as hot. Electronic music is very good at that because you can program it in and it just goes right on, unwavering. So that was definitely one factor that, like, the hillbilly music and the other stuff has, jazz band, jazz music from the 20s. It's got that fast forward motion. But there was
and one question there, if I can jump in.
Yeah.
The title
yeah,
of the book and the title of the CD, you call it Stomp, but during the text of the book, you mostly call it Drive.
That's because I had a publisher.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And I think Stomp and Swerve, I love alliteration. So, But anyway, okay. I just want to clarify that when you say Drive.
It really Drive is kind of what I'm talking about. It's that speed of the music. It's moving forward. It's got forward momentum. But, forward momentum can become monotonous. And hot music, the thing is always what makes it hot is it's surprising. And for that, I came up with the concept of swerve, which I swiped from the classical poet Lucretius, who I'd spent a bunch of time studying.
And I've got to read this quote from Lucretius that I think it does a great job of defining it. I'm not going to read it in Latin, so forgive me to the two listeners who would understand the original Latin. But it's Lucretius said, "At some uncertain place in space and time, they deviated from their given course by just enough so you could say it changed."
Yeah, this is Lucretius explained the world by saying that atoms fall down in parallel. Basically, all the atoms are in free fall and were like that until this thing, this swerve, he called it a quinamen in Latin, happened. And there's no explanation for it. It just happened. And one atom bumped into another one, and that set off a chain reaction, and that clumped atoms together into things, and suddenly you've got the world. And that for me, it's that life force, that kind of inexplicable bit. Why is it doing this? It's there's no explanation for like stuff. It's like Louis Armstrong just blasting, like ripping up to the high notes, and just before he hits the high note, he suddenly backpedals and goes down the scale and then races up again to hit the high note. It's like, wait, why did he do that? He had a climax and he just made it 10 times as hot by backing off of it for a second.
I just want to jump in because I'm adding musical excerpts is a new thing we're doing on the show, so I'm pretty bad at it. But I really want to include a sample right now of a record you cite as having Drive, which is Bessie Smith's seminal 1925 version of St. Louis Blues. So, Steph, if you could cue up just a couple minutes of that or 30 seconds or so, and then we'll follow it with an example of Swerve, which you picked several really good ones, but the one that hit me the closest was ragtime obsessed trombonist Arthur Pryor smearing and blatting his way through trombone sneeze in 1902. So if we can just have a taste of those stuff, and then we'll be right back to the show. So now that we've heard some examples of what you're talking about, and to the untutored ear, I mean, this is wild shit. The thing that hooked me on old music was when I was a kid, I got my hands on a cassette version of the Smithsonian collection of classic country music and the Smithsonian collection of classic jazz music. And to say little minds were blown is an understatement. Just the recording quality alone became something. A future Pussy Galore and Yoko Ono fan was clearly born right there, you know, because my love for the sheer noise of the sound of the 78 being recorded. Yeah. But you've got a great quote from country music scholar Robert Cantwell in his book Bluegrass Breakdown on what the European ear hears when Africa is in the house. That's your terminology. But but Cantwell says, "Tones grow hair, go blind or explode. Notes bend, break, weaken, collapse, or leave home. Melodies compulsively juggle handfuls of notes or fling them wildly away. Rhythms spill over in syncopations. Horns growl, hiss, cough, and squeak. Banjos snarl, snap, and bite. Fiddles cry and wail. Singing voices shout, holler, call, moan, and weep. Fill with gravel, smoke, or weeds. Cower in the nasal cavities or in one corner of the mouth and sink luxuriously into some lower region of the anatomy, and sometimes even slip into mere speech or something worse, like nonsense syllables." He's describing scatting there at the end, but tell me how you found this quote and what it means to you.
Well, you know, I read whatever I could find on this stuff, which isn't a lot. It wasn't a lot at the time, and it's still not a lot. There have been a couple big books since I wrote Stomp and Swear, but not a lot. You know, it still hasn't been studied to the degree that it should be. But when I read that, I mean, I thought that was just a beautiful piece of writing, you know, just really, really strong, evocative writing. But it also really describes Swerve to me. It can be tonal, it can be melodic, it can be rhythmic. Syncopation is Swerve, where you speed up a little part of the, you know, of each measure, so that the beat doesn't fall in the exact place that you're going to expect it to fall. There's all kinds of ways of swerving things. And it's putting in almost this this human element against the divine element that is, you know, the harmony of the spheres aspect that you get in music, where it's where music is applied mathematics. And Swerve is kind of the opposite of that.
It's almost like quantum music or something. I mean, I feel like the Europeans were trying to systematize music. And obviously, you know, the European musical tradition is one of the great gifts to world culture, as you can see just the way it's adopted in China so much now. But there was this attempt to rationalize music and to understand music, like you say, in mathematical terms. And then we collide with Africa, or we invade Africa, however you want to look at it. But we hear all this music that's manifestly brilliant music. I mean, from day one, the Europeans had to acknowledge, wow, these people can sing and play, and yet they're not following any of our rules that we're trying to put together. They're breaking.
No, their music is completely different, you know, and different in a really compelling way also to the European ear, because Europeans found music throughout the world in their colonial experience. And the only one that really got incorporated was African music, which is interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting because I'd say you could probably make a case for Indian music at this point.
That's a good point, but that took a while.
Yeah, that took a little while later, and then you've got great traditions like Chinese and Japanese music, which go way back, and there's a lot of depth to them, but they still remain very alien to the Western ear.
Same with like Native American music. If you listen to like Navajo recordings and things, those have not really, don't appear to have had a lot of influence in American music.
Yes, definitely not. But you also then break it down into something, a connection that had never occurred to me before. I think I understood it intuitively because North American music, obviously, North America produced rock and roll and jazz and hip hop and all this booming, thrusting, aggressive music. And we tend to associate that with African music. But you point out that all over the rest of the Americas, you actually have more African music, more directly influenced, Afro-Brazilian music, for example, or Afro-Caribbean music is actually closer to the music you hear in Africa than the music you hear in North America. And you sort of point a finger at my people, the Scots-Irish people and the Irish, the Celtic folks here in America as being maybe the source of that. And explain some of that and the reasons why you think white music influenced African-American musicians more than it in North America, more than it may have influenced them in South America or the Caribbean.
Well, there are a few reasons. One, while researching this book, I read some very big books on the history of slavery in the Americas, which is, never a pleasant read, but always worth
the time. Yeah. And you
exactly.
You actually pointed me at Hugh Thomas's Magisterial, The Slave Trade, which I have skimmed and read some summaries of and read a couple of chapters. And yeah, if you want to learn Hugh Thomas's Slave Trade,
that's the place.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It is grim history. And unlike Germany, who has at least begun to reckon with the Holocaust, America, I feel like, has done nothing to reckon with the evil we have wreaked on our fellow.
Certainly damn little, and not God. there are places of hope, but that's for another discussion. But
yeah, for sure. That's way bigger than this show. But let's get back to the comparison between.
So. When you look at like how the slave trade worked in North America as opposed to how it was in the Caribbean or South America, the Caribbean and South America were, they had these huge plantations that were just charnel houses. They just kept shipping three people through and throwing away the bodies. But there were very few Europeans involved in their administration. It was the culture there was just was very strongly African because there was no contact between the Africans and the Europeans or very little. And then in the U.S. Or America, rather, in North America, a lot of the slaves were parceled out and owned by small slaveholders. There was a much greater buy-in into slavery. But that meant that there were people who had like two or three slaves, and that these
as opposed to 200 or 2,000.
Exactly. And these people lived among people who were not African, and so they had to adapt and were forced into a new culture. That it was very difficult to maintain a pure African culture, and I read a lot of travel books through America, especially through the South, from the 18th century and 19th century. It's always been an interest of mine, just even independent of the music. But you see a lot of depictions of African enslaved people making music for things like white picnics. And they'd be playing banjos and also fiddles, which is not an African instrument. That was and the fiddle was brought from England and also from Ireland, and was a prominent European instrument used for country dances in the Irish tradition and to a degree in the English tradition.
Yeah, and exactly, and And one point I'd like to nudge out is that, you know, the fiddle or the violin is central to the high European tradition we were talking about earlier. But when you call it the fiddle, it's very Celtic, and it's very key to the Celtic music, which is, oddly enough, as you point out, a cousin of the kind of music you hear in West Africa, where Arabian music mixed with the native West African music. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it gets really complicated. But you've got, you know, in a way, you've got, like, string music is string music. One string instrument can easily play with another string instrument. And so you get these things where you get the banjo keeping the rhythm, and the violin, the fiddle, you know, playing the melody, and you've got dance music. And I mean, this is really the beginnings of a unique American music, is with these depictions of musicians in places like Virginia and the Carolinas in the late 18th century. So it really goes back. Of course, we've got no strong depiction or description of the music they're playing, and, you know, nobody wrote it down in notation or paid all that much attention to it. But clearly it was there, and it got to the point where a lot of African transplants, a lot of these enslaved people, mastered the violin. They mastered Western instruments, European instruments. And so you start to see these hybridized traditions getting handed down. And that's, you know, that's where we start to really see American music come together.
Yeah, and you had a great quote that I should have quoted earlier, but you list lots of the music of the African influenced music of the Americas. You've got the tango in Argentina, and Uruguay, the candom. Brazil has all kinds of African-inflected mm-hmm. music, like the samba. Colombia has its loopy driving cumbaya. You know, the Caribbean is stuffed to the gills with Afro-American beats. Whereas the United States has gospel, ragtime, jazz, the blues, and so-called hillbilly music. And these are just the traditional types. And then you say, yet if you had to take one of these, which of these objects doesn't belong tests about the music of the African diaspora in the Americas, the answer is obvious. Something happened to the African music in Anglo-Saxon North America that didn't happen to it anywhere else. And you've already explained the reason why. And I want to but you sum it up really elegantly, I think, when you say, at their most animated, when everybody's goes flat out, theirs meaning the rest of the Americas, South mm-hmm. American Caribbean music trots, North American music runs. Whenever North American musicians approach the edge of chaos, they've got a distinct tendency to want to lean over it as far as they can go.
I mean, I still believe that's extreme. That's really true. I mean, you listen to Louis Armstrong doing St. Louis Blues, where he just starts shredding it, you know, and it's like, whoa, okay, this is something different, you know, or
Earl Palmer taking a syncopation out of the beat for Little Richard's Tutti Frutti. I mean, that's just, you know, going for that raw power and that crazed aggression. And you've got some great quotes about the relationship between the Africans who found themselves enslaved here. Imagine the difficulty of preserving your native language, culture, music under those circumstances, impossibly far from home, stuck among a hard, often cruel people in a vast, dangerous, and above all alien land. And yet, African music persisted in North America, if in a form less pure than one finds in other lands of the diaspora. It's like their musical gifts were so strong that they survived all this. And I love, as a proud Scots-Irish, you know, you nail it with the hard, cruel, or, you know, hard, often
cruel people, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Borgen, Texas, in the Texas Panhandle, and the original mm-hmm. town slogan was 30 miles from water, 6 feet from hell. And
that's about right. Yeah. Well, my mom's people pioneered Western Maine, so they were not soft people. They were not overly imbued with the milk of human kindness either.
No, but they did have musical gifts.
Yeah, at least to a degree. You know, it needed a little bringing out. But, you know, one of the things, one of the people I was listening to as I wrote this book was Michael Coleman, the great Irish fiddler, you know, just one of the great performing musicians of the 20th century, just an amazing virtuoso, just this absolutely fluid, liquid player with an unbelievable sense of rhythm. And you listen to him closely and you listen to him playing these Irish jigs, and he's playing really fast. And he's always leaning in on the beat, you know, he's always driving it ahead. And that's what I think the Irish gave, you know, is that we're not just going to play the music, we're going to push the music.
And here's another one I'd like to jump in and let's hear a little bit of the song you pick out. And I might have the pronunciation wrong. The Monahan?
Yeah, the Monahan.
And so we'll listen to that. Tell us a little bit about it before we cut into the song.
Oh, it's just, you know, it's a classic Irish jig. It's got a couple parts, but Coleman takes it off at a really high clip and just leans in, and he's just pushing the beat just ever so slightly, but it gives it this, like, kind of headlong running down a hill quality that a lot of his jigs have. And, you know, I've been to Irish weddings by accident late at night when people are maybe a little...
In their cups.
And yes. And dancing to the fiddle. And, you know, people are just flinging each other around. I mean, it really is still part of Irish music and Irish culture. And it's funny as hell, but it's impressive. I mean, there's a real dedication to pushing the edge of chaos there.
Yeah, and you call it Coleman's performance demonstrates the same fierceness, the same implicit violence. So let's hear a little bit of that stuff. Well, that's something else. I mean, you hear that, and if you never heard anything like that, I mean, if you never heard Coleman, you've never heard anything like that before. At this point in 2018, that is not something you come across every day.
No, I mean, you hear it in Southern fiddle tunes, you know, from the 1920s and a lot of hillbilly music, but even they're not quite as, well, some of them are pretty driving, but a lot of them aren't even as driving as he is.
Yeah, to me, it's... like the difference between having a nice cup of sleepy time tea with some chamomile and valerian root and taking a big old snort at China White with Johnny Thunders, you know, I mean,
yeah, it's bracing.
Yes. And so you've got another record in here that you talk about that I think is equally bracing. You say, you know, there's no one record as typical of West African music as a Coleman disc is of Irish music, but you pick out a record called, and correct my pronunciation if I'm wrong, by Yad Dankor by the Kumasi Trio. I recorded.
Yeah, I can't correct your pronunciation, unfortunately, because you know, I'm not. I don't speak the languages there, but yeah, that's one that I fortunately, you know, found on CD, and I was just listening to the Kumasi Trio, and you listen to that record, and it's there's definitely a beat to it, but there's more than one. You know, Michael Coleman's got one beat, and he's crowding it. And these guys have got like several beats going on. There's a guy hitting a wood block or you know, like a clave, and I'll be damned if I can figure out the pattern to it, you know, but
yeah,
you know, there's a pattern. It's just, it's like so many gears. African music is so intricate when it comes to rhythm, you know, that it's like, it would be a shame to have just one rhythm going.
Absolutely. And you describe it really well in the book. You say, in fact, there really is no beat as Michael Coleman would have understood it. The beat is implied, not stated, something to dance around. There's a backspun sort of drive, sure, but more swerve than we know how to handle. The result to our ears sounds lazy, ragged, almost chaotic. In fact, it's anything but, as lending a careful ear to the deliberate, precise percussion demonstrates. And so let's hear a few seconds of that so people can get a taste of what we're talking about with Yad Dankor by the Kumasi Trio. featuring the virtuoso Ghanaian guitarist Jacob Sam. All right. I mean, if again, that's something that you don't hear every day in 2018.
No, it's something we don't have a real framework for, you know. It's we live in kind of a golden age for reissued music now. You can get almost anything. But the really early stuff, there was a flowering about 10, 15 years ago, and everything got put out. And it just failed to make a mark, at least visibly. Although I've had a couple of recent experiences that show that, you know, there's something going on. But it still sounds pretty alien.
Very alien. And I think what happened was the economics of the CD were so juicy for the music industry that you could put out virtually anything on a CD, find even a small mm-hmm. audience and make a profit. And you're already seeing that music vanishing again. It was sort of like the way video stores in the late 90s had every movie yeah. ever. And now Netflix has this limited selection that changes every month. And so the streaming services are not very likely to be carrying the Stomp and Swerve CD, much less the really obscure stuff. But thanks to YouTube, and I like Google Play Music because you can upload your own tunes to it. But YouTube, yeah, yeah. you can find almost anything that's ever been put on CD, as long as nobody's being overzealous about the copyright protection, which and right. none of this stuff is still in copyright. Yeah. So.
And there are now like digital online libraries that have lots of MP3s of early recordings. So that's kind of interesting. They're not universal yet. It's not like you don't have anything like Google Books, as far as I can tell.
Not yet.
Where you've just got it's yeah. coming though.
Yeah, it's coming, and I think if we if everybody pitches in, we can preserve this music. And also you know. I talked to Peter Doggett about his excellent book, Electric Shock, The History of Recorded Music. And, you know, one thing that people forget is in the early days of the Edison, and I can't remember if he's got the phonograph or the gramophone off the top of my head, but mm-hmm. those had each performance had to be each disc had to be recorded with a new performance. Whereas, yeah. you know, the gramophone, Caruso could record once and they could, you know, print off thousands of them before the masters went out. So
yeah, the cylinders were tough.
Yes. So some weird things.
I mean,
going
eventually
on.
They found a way of molding them, but early on, no. I mean, you would put like five recording machines to get five cylinders.
Yeah. Know? And somebody, and some of those guys had to record, 40,000 takes of something.
Yeah.
If they had a hit,
yeah.
like what a curse. But I want to
give. They're all different.
Yeah. Everyone's unique, which you yeah. know, with it's just like a chess game. Every move you make means that you create a new strength and you lose it, yeah. an old weakness. I mean, it's there's always yeah. trade-offs. But before yeah. we're, you know, as is my want, I've dived so deep, we're not covering the material as much as I wanted to. But I wanted to get to two artists in particular. Daniel Decatur Emmett and basically the inventor of minstrelsy and his group, the Virginia Minstrels. So – tell us about that. I mean, this is a topic, talk about controversial.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, there had been already for, 20 years, people like white guys had been imitating on the stage, black musicians and dancers. And, they rubbed burnt cork on their face to do it and pretended, basically pretended to be black, and white audiences either laughed or applauded depending on the kind of act it was. The dancers, they usually just, you know, that wasn't comedy, but there was comedy mixed in at the expense of, you know, the ragged black population of America, which was ragged because they were being denied basic human rights and had no money or anything. So,
yeah. And that's an important point I like to make here. I mean, it's easy to bash the Virginia Minstrels for being racist, but let's keep in mind that they lived in a context in which chattel slavery was the norm, and chattel yeah. slavery was a unique invention of the Europeans around the 16th, 17th century that's also uniquely horrible. I mean, a completely new level of dehumanization. You know, people talk about slavery going back to the beginning of time and being present in every culture. Well, chattel slavery was not, and chattel slavery
was horrible. Yeah. That had the unique, aspects of modernity to it, where it was all-encompassing and almost mechanized in its ruthlessness.
Yeah, and enforced on generation after generation. But let's get back to Emmett and the music. So what happened in the Five Points of New York?
So what happened is, he was hanging around in his rooms one day with a couple other guys, Frank Pelham, a couple other guys who were known also for Emmett played banjo and sang and, you know, blacked up and did it. And basically imitate the African-American musicians, because African-Americans had a reputation for music at this point. African-American music was already recognized as being something interesting by white America, not to the point where they would actually allow African American entertainers on the stage and pay them and give them dignity, but their music was certainly interesting enough. You know, this is an age long before recorded music, so you could either put it out on a sheet music or you could get up on stage and play it, and that was the only way to get music around. And some of these guys were taking the songs that they heard down south from enslaved people and free blacks and black entertainers, and they were stealing them and blacking up and playing them on stage. So a couple of these guys were sitting around. They'd been working as individual acts. Like one guy would come out and play a banjo and sing a song in between somebody else who would do like Swiss minstrelsy. That was the Swiss minstrels were famous at the time, who'd yodel and play bells and, you know, all this other variety act type stuff. And these four guys who were professionals were sitting around. I'm sure they were probably drinking some. And they had their instruments, and they started to jam, which was weird. They started to play a couple songs. One guy played the tambourine, which was a common African-American instrument. One guy played the bones, another common African-American instrument. Daniel Decatur Emmett played the fiddle, and you had a banjo guy. And so these four started playing, and they say, hey, you know, this sounds pretty good. So they took it to the stage next door of the American Hotel, which was basically a bar with a few rooms upstairs and a little stage in the bar room. And this was in January 1843. And they start playing, and everybody just starts falling out. It's like, what the hell is this? This is amazing. Because they weren't playing it as individuals. They had formed a band doing this stuff. They found a kind of a fake African-American musical vocabulary that worked, that imitated African music while still being a spectacle, while covering some of their own audience's concerns. You know, they had to be loud. They had to be demonstrative. They were playing for tough New York City audiences on the Bowery.
Yeah, and, the legendary Bowery, which, you know.
Yeah, the legendary, which is.
Anybody who's seen Gangs of New York knows what we're talking about with the Bowery. And it goes all the way up to CBGB's in the 1970s. I mean, this neighborhood was rough and tough for well over a century. And I think we do owe them the service of naming each of the guys. So I've got the book here handy, which is an advantage I have over you. Yeah, so yeah, Dick Pelham and Frank Bauer keeping time on tambourine and bones, which was nothing more than a pair of cattle ribs that you rattled like musical spoons. Then you had Emmett on fiddle, and then you had Billy Whitlock on percussive violin. And there's a great description. You try to grapple with the question of what did they sound like? And you said, the songs are basically Turkey in the Straw, which is Emmett's name for it.
Yeah.
Before that it was Zip Coon. So, you know, he's already making it less racist than the material he had to work with. And I'm not trying to make excuses for their racism. I mean, these guys were racist, but it was a totally racist culture. But the important part is the music. And as you saw, you quote, as a witness to their antics observed, it could be very difficult to describe their performance in libretto, and musical score would not do it justice. Pelham, for instance, seemed animated by a savage energy, and in an age where real musicians were supposed to sit still, his frenzied tambourine bashing, quote, nearly rung him off his seat. Whitlock frailed away at his gut-string banjo with, quote, complete abandon, while Emmett furiously hacked a fiddle held backwood-style at his chest, and Brower kept popping up from his chair to stomp around the stage in his boots while rapidly rattling a pair of rib bones in each hand, putting the whole arm into it. I mean, you know, it's like imagining Brian Jones and Keith Richards and Mick Jagger getting together for the first time, pretty much.
I mean, basically, it was the superstars of the scene, and they got together, and they were, you know, as in all bands, they were playing together, but they were also playing in competition with each other, you know, they were pushing each other onto greater heights. And they invented something. I mean, everybody recognized it. They immediately went on tour. They went to England right away. It was the Sex Pistols tour in reverse, because they went to England and broke up, just like the Sex Pistols came here and broke up. And but then, you know, they'd already like lit this match, and soon you start seeing Christie's Minstrels, all these other people doing it. Dan Emmett joined Christie's Minstrels eventually and wrote Dixie, or stole it fair and square, as the case may be. And it becomes this huge explosion. Already in 1850, Jerry Thomas, the guy who wrote the first Bartender's Guide, is out in California as a 20-year-old, and he's tending bar for a while, and then he starts managing a minstrel band and going around the mining camps and sticking up show posters with pine tar. And so it had spread everywhere. You know, it was part of America. It was immediately recognized. It was something that we all in America, it was a part of American culture that had been there, and they just brought it to the fore and shoved it in people's faces in a way that hadn't been done before.
Yeah. And
so
and
they kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just want to, I basically want to wrap with a selection from Fiddlin' John Carson's 1924 version of Old Dan Tucker, which was one of the Virginia Minstrels songs. I mean, I believe Emmett wrote that, or at least, you know, made it his own. Yeah, he wrote that song. And it's, this was another thing that was fascinating to me, was realizing that these 1920 recordings that we think of as, wow, this is the most archaic, purest form of Anglo-Celtic American music you can find. And if you really dig into it like you have, no, it's not. What it is these hillbillies are doing 50-year-old, what was popular 50 years earlier, and it was totally African-American music, or the best imitation they could. So let's hear Fiddlin' John Carson and just for a few seconds of that. So, David, I mean, this has been amazing. Once again, I have failed to cover the topic, but the book is Stomp and Swerve, and I think it was a very enlightening and educating and exciting to me, and I cannot recommend the companion CD high enough. If you like old music, if you like exploring music like you haven't heard before, there's a ton here, and there's a ton of nuance we could dig. I mean, we didn't even get to Burt Williams.
There's so much. I mean, it's an overwhelming amount. When writing this book, I just felt like I was, skimming the tops of the peaks. I mean, you get into like Will Marion Cook and his Afro-American folk song singers, which is just some of the most sophisticated swinging music like 20, 30 years before swing. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy what was out there and you know, only some of which made it to record. But it's been a real pleasure coming and talking about this. I have to say, this is a part of our culture and part of my personal path through life that I will always want to revisit.
Well, excellent. And, you know, usually when a guest compliments me like that, I immediately get them to commit to come back on the show. So your offer is accepted and we'll have you back.
Happy to do it.
And we'll take it a little bit forward. We got about to 1840. So and the book starts in 1843. So we've got a lot of ground to cover, several chapters more of the book. And so we'll definitely have you back on our fourth or fifth season of the show. I can't remember which it is at this point. But again, David Wondrich, author of Stomp and Swerve, thanks again for coming on the show. It's really
been fun. Thank you so much. This was a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Next week, author Robert Gordon returns to discuss Can't Be Satisfied, his biography of Muddy Waters. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Stomp and Swerve, How American Music Got Hot, 1843 to 1924, is available from Chicago Review Press and can be found wherever fine books are sold. Also, don't miss the accompanying CD or streaming collection of the same title available from Amazon.